Today's Taisho will be on Case 6 in the Wumong Kan. Case 6 is entitled, The Buddha Holds Out a Flower. When Shakyamuni Buddha was at Mount Gridhrakuta, he held out a flower to his listeners. Everyone was silent. Only Mahakashapa broke into a broad smile. The Buddha said, I have the true Dharma eye, the marvelous mind of Nirvana, the true form of the formless, and the subtle Dharma gate, independent of words and transmitted beyond doctrines. This I have entrusted to Mahakashapa. Mumon's comment, golden-faced Gautama really disregarded his listeners. He made the good look bad and sold dog meat labeled as mutton. He himself thought it was wonderful. If, however, everyone in the audience had laughed, how could he have transmitted the true I? And again, if Mahakashapa had not smiled, how could the Buddha have transmitted it? If you say the true eye of Dharma can be transmitted, then the golden-faced old man would be a city slicker who cheats the country bumpkin. If you say it cannot be transmitted, then why did the Buddha approve of Mahakashapa? Mumon's verse, holding out a flower, the Buddha betrayed his curly tail. Heaven and earth were bewildered at Mahakashapa's smile. Thank you very much for coming to practice Zen today. As we were walking outside doing our kinhin, I found myself asking if this can really be August in New Jersey. Because as you probably know very well, August in New Jersey is usually very hot, very muggy. And outside today, it's cool, low humidity. It's really quite extraordinary. The sun is shining. And as we did our kinhin today, there were no brass bands to get in our way. There were no cheerleading squads. There were no jackhammers. They must be on a lunch break. So it was really a wonderful chain of circumstances made that beautiful walk possible. And one of the things that made that walk so special or so wonderful is doing Zazen. You know, when we take time out from our lives to sit down on the cushion and calm the mind and enter deep samadhi, we have done something really quite extraordinary, as this koan is trying to indicate. And when we get off the cushion and we walk outside the zendo and we circumambulate a fountain, which was actually running today, which is quite unusual too, you know, it can be a wonderful experience because the barriers between ourself and the world have dropped away or are a little less powerful. And so we experience things as they are with a kind of immediacy that isn't normally there when we're distracted by thoughts or overcome by our emotions or compulsions. So, you know, taking a walk in deep samadhi is a form of deep contact not only with the world, but we Zen people believe with our truest selves. So today's koan is very, very famous, describes a very, very famous scene. Buddha holds out a flower. You know, it was traditional for the Buddha to give special talks at a place called Mount Gridhrakuta, which means vulture peak. So the Buddha would lead his retinue up a hill to a very high point, looking out over a very large plain, like a vast plain. And he would offer his teachings for the week or for some period. And people would follow him up there and listen to him speak. And in the sutras, this is often represented as a very important event, going up to Vulture Peak and hearing the Buddha deliver his teachings. And in the sutras, it's often represented as the Buddha going up to the peak with a vast crowd and people, like 1,000 people, listening to him speak. Actually, if you go to Vulture Peak, which I have never been to, but many people have been to, they tell me it's actually a very small space. You know, there weren't thousands of people up there listening to him. There were, you know, maybe 12 people listening to him. Somehow, what he said had great impact all the same. You know, the Buddha would lead a retinue, maybe not of thousands, maybe of a dozen, maybe of dozens, who knows, up this peak, and he would deliver teachings. And, you know, people would be practicing meditation, but they needed some guidance from the Buddha. And he would offer them some guidance in the form of his talks. So, you know, people would come up, maybe people from the village, maybe monks and nuns, to hear something about what their where their practice was going, or what was really real, or maybe they were stuck in their lives, or they were unhappy. And they would come up and listen to the Buddha speak. And the Buddha would speak, you know, would usually hold forth for some period of time and deliver talk, and people would hear the talk. And they would go back to their villages, or back to their town, or back to their monastery or convent, and be inspired in their practice. But on this occasion, people came to hear the Buddha speak, and they were waiting. And you could imagine, if you want to, the way most people who hear this teisho or hear this koan, you know, they imagine a great crowd of people, maybe 1,000 people, waiting for the Buddha to speak. And, you know, it's this big throng. It's like Rutgers Stadium, which holds a great throng, but is also usually empty. A great throng of people listening for the Buddha to speak, and then the Buddha surprises them by saying nothing, but instead just holding up a flower. You know, this is a very, very famous koan and a very famous story in the Zen tradition. Maybe it even happened. We live by ideas. We live by with our discriminating intellect. And we put so much faith in this idea that some truth, some words, or some insight is going to transform our lives. This is quite fundamental to how most people think. You know, if you go to the bookstore, there's a whole enormous volume of books which are called self-help books, or now they're marketed as psychology. And if you know, and the books talk about how to understand yourself, how to understand your life, and there are also more, you could say, esoteric books. You know, there are books on Buddhism, there are books on Hinduism, there are books on Judaism and Christianity, and there's books on mystical practices. There's A Course of Miracles, you know, and there's many, many books, you know, that people read, and they, you know, underline key ideas. People go to lectures. So when guest speakers come, you know, people go to hear the guest speaker. You know, some speaker will offer some insight, you know, and I remember, you know, I work in an English department, and people really put great faith in ideas, you know. If a great philosopher comes to Rutgers, 1,000 people might show up, and they're waiting for some word that will transform their lives. You know, I think that ideas are important. You know, ideas are important. If you fill your head with junk, that has an effect on you. And if you fill your head with more valuable or carefully chosen items, you know, you're likely to have a better life. So it probably is better to read something that's really a good book as opposed to something that's just killing time, you know. But I think it's better maybe to read books than to watch, say, some TV shows or things like that. I personally feel that way. I think surfing the web is probably sometimes a waste of time, even though we all do it. So, you know, I think that ideas do matter. You know, choosing your ideas carefully, and I think having an understanding of things is important. So, you know, if you're interested in Buddhism, please get some books on Buddhism. You know, if you're interested in democracy, read something about democracy. You know, learning is a good thing, not a bad thing. So, you know, sometimes this koan is misunderstood. Ideas are important. But I think people overestimate the power of ideas to change their lives. You know, we have so much faith that if we just hear the right point or we just read the right thing, the next day our lives are going to be different, that we don't really necessarily, we can't really necessarily be honest with ourselves. That often, you know, these insights which we underline or circle and put an exclamation mark next to in our books, you know, they just sit on the shelf and we finish the book and we feel change for a little while, but pretty soon nothing has really changed. I have found people who have so much faith in ideas and they embrace a philosophy or a way of thinking. And it's tremendously exciting for them for a while, and then they lose interest and they drop it and they move on to something else, and then it's exciting and all this time, you know, they're really pretty much, their lives are pretty much the same, pretty much unchanged. The Buddhism really is skeptical, a little bit skeptical about the power of ideas to change our life, just ideas by themselves. And that, you know, if you have a problem with anger, you know, you can read a book on anger, but it probably won't free you from the problem of anger. It probably won't. And if you have a problem with being fearful, maybe your basic instinctual makeup is fearful, you know. You can read a book about being more self-assertive and it might inspire you, but probably your mental habits are very deeply ingrained and reading a book is not going to change them. So, you know, Buddhism is pretty skeptical about the power of ideas alone to change people or to make life better. It doesn't say that ideas are valueless, because the Buddha himself delivered many sutras, many discourses. And if you bother to go to the library and look out books on Zen, there's a huge volume of writing. So it's not so much that you should not have any respect for ideas, it's just that they don't really profoundly change the way you experience from moment to moment. You know, when we're not in our heads, we tend to go back to a default position. You know, when we're not totally absorbed in thoughts, we tend to slip back into a default position, and our thoughts may not really change much our default position. So, you know, how do we change our default position? You know, how do we change our basic consciousness? You know, and that's very difficult because so much of that processing is unconscious. It's below the level of our conscious mind. And that's why words really can't reach it, why words really can't change us, you know. So something like Zazen is a very unique kind of practice, because it isn't just about ideas. It's not about the particular thoughts we're thinking, but about how the mind itself processes information. You know, so we're changing. You could say, you know, the thoughts we think are like the products of like the software, you know, or the thoughts we think are like what we see on the screen. But what Zen is getting at is the machinery behind the screen. You know, it's changing the machinery itself, the machinery of consciousness. So, you know, actually, it's important to stop thinking if you want to change the machinery of your consciousness. Because thinking is often just a screen for what's really going on underneath. You know, I was reading, somebody was kind enough to send me something from the New York Times. And there was an article in the New York Times a couple weeks ago about how very little people like to introspect. And it said, you know, these psychologists were measuring people or studying people's attitudes toward their own mental processing. And they found that people, after about 5 minutes, become very uncomfortable when they're paying attention to what's happening in their minds, when they begin to introspect or look into the mind. And that people get very, very nervous or uncomfortable when they become aware of their own mental processing. And they try to distract themselves. This is typically what happens. And I myself have seen this. You know, in my family, people kept busy all the time. Busyness was how people dealt with their confusion or unhappiness, you know. So if you're uncomfortable with what's happening inside yourself, you could say, you know, you could get up and clean the floor, or you could go chop wood, or you could read a book. You could do many different things that would keep you very busy, very busy, very focused on what's happening. But you wouldn't really be paying attention to your own mental processing. And my wife's family are like this too. You know, they're busy, 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 busy people all the time. You know, as soon as they get up, they're doing things. And it by the end of the day, it's so exhausting to be around them. But you know, actually, I don't think they like to introspect. You know, they're all sort of artists, and they don't like to really take time, have too much time to think. Not thoughts, but about what's happening in their own minds, about their own emotions, their own mental processing. So a lot of people use busyness, constant busyness, to mask what's going on in their head. And I actually think thinking masks what's going on in our heads too, you know, actually. So again, I'm not putting down thinking. I'm not saying it's bad. And I'm not saying we should pay no attention to ideas or that poetry and literature don't matter, because I love those things. But often we use thinking to screen out what's really bothering us, really bothering us. If you've been married for a long time, as I have, I've been married for something like 37 years, you realize that you have fights over things that don't really matter because you don't want to confront what you're not really facing, you know? So, people, I've known people who have had fights. My uncle and my aunt had a huge fight over which way the loose flap of toilet paper on a roll should hang. So, you know, there's one school of thought that says that the loose flap should face the user, right? So it goes over the top of the roll and it hangs down frontally, right? There's another school of thought that says, no, it should be the other way. The loose flap should be hanging down from behind. Maybe you can visualize these two alternatives. And, you know, if you go into a hotel, it's usually the loose flap faces you, and it goes over the top of the roll, and they fold it to make like a little arrow. I don't know if you've noticed that, but it's very elegant. It's thought to be elegant. So anyway, my aunt and my uncle had a big fight over which way to roll the toilet paper, and it went on for days. You know, nobody really cares about which way you organize a roll of toilet paper. That wasn't really what it was all about. They had many unresolved issues in their relationship that they just weren't facing. And instead, they had a fight over the toilet paper, you know? And this is very common. You know, if you're in any kind of relationship, sometimes people argue over really trivial things. You know, somebody will, if you're on a committee, you know, somebody will criticize some of the writing in a report. And what they're really angry about might be quite different. It might be that they feel they should have written the report, or they feel the boss isn't giving them enough compliments, you know. So our thinking process often masks what's really going on. We often use words and ideas to avoid confronting the fact that something inside us is difficult to come to terms with. Buddhism isn't about really ideas. It's not. In fact, you know, the Buddha actually says things about ideas and says don't trust them. You know, in the Diamond Sutra, for example, which is the major sutra for Zen, again and again the Buddha will introduce an idea like liberation or like enlightenment. And later he'll say, but remember, the word enlightenment is just a word. The idea of liberation is just an idea, you know. And then he'll go on to say, look, you know, these are not real. Don't think your salvation lies in changing one set of ideas for another set of ideas. Change the way you process your basic processing, as we would say now. He doesn't use that word. So meditation is about changing the way we process the inputs. Because we have all of these deeply ingrained habits, and we have all of this going on under the surface, which we don't always come to terms with. And you know, and I that article in the New York Times really shed a lot of light for me on why people don't necessarily meditate, which I have to tell you has been a big mystery for me all my life. You know. I started doing meditation when I was 22 years old. And even though it was difficult for me to sit still, I felt very liberated by the experience, you know. And I've never stopped doing it. I just love it, and I feel very liberated by it. And I am surprised sometimes when people will come to our introduction, beginner's night, on a Monday or a Friday, and do meditation and say, this is really great, and they don't come back. You know, it's like, why not, you know? But I think the New York Times article, you know, it's sometimes difficult to sit down on a cushion and stop thinking, because then, you know, what's underneath the surface comes out. Yeah, I remember there was a person who had been coming to meditation for about 6 months. And he was talking to somebody who had just been coming for meditation for a couple days. So this person had come like on a Friday night, and then he'd come on another Friday night. And he said, the newest person said, wow, this is really great. You know, I sit down on the cushion and all my anxiety disappears and all my thoughts cease. And the other person said, yeah, that's what happens at first, but later it all comes back. And I thought that was true too. You know, what he was saying is that, you know, at first when you start meditating, you are in the moment and your mind is clear and you're liberated. But then if you keep meditating, you know, things start bubbling up from under the surface that you have to face. And that's the difficult part of meditation practice. And it's what meditation is all about, is changing the way we experience the world from moment to moment on the most elemental level. And that means working through some of this some of these problems that we have. So anyway, this famous koan involves an incident where everybody was coming to hear the Buddha speak. Everybody was coming to hear the Buddha speak. And they were you could say, grasping at the idea that some insight or some word from the Buddha would set them free. And instead of speaking, the Buddha held up a flower. And people were, you could say, unprepared for that moment. You know, they didn't know intellectually what the Buddha meant, but also they weren't able to be present with the experience, you know? So, you know, possibly some monk was sitting in the audience waiting for the Buddha to speak, and he was thinking about some difficult issue in scripture, in the sutras. Maybe the Buddha had said something about karma, you know? And the monk was maybe having trouble with his meditation practice, and he was wondering if it was karma. Is there something in a past life I did that's preventing me from having a breakthrough now? You know, and then maybe he was thinking, am I a bad person? Am I a good person? You know, I've tried to be a good monk. I try not to be selfish. I try to put others before me. And thinking all of this as the Buddha holds up a flower. And the Buddha holds up the flower, but, you know, in a way, the monk wouldn't be able to see it because he'd be so caught up in his own mental baggage, you know. He'd be thinking. And he's thinking, and as he's thinking, the Buddha holds up a flower, and then the Buddha puts it down, and the moment has come and the moment has gone. And he wasn't able to be 100% with that moment. So he missed the opportunity to learn from what the Buddha was teaching that day. There's probably many people were like this, right? They were looking for something that would stimulate their intellectual faculties, which is great. Or they were lost in thought, or they had anxieties. Maybe some of them felt that they had been passed over by the hierarchy, or some of them felt that they weren't respected enough. Maybe some of them wished the Buddha would look their way and acknowledge their contribution to the Sangha. Everybody's sort of caught up in his thing, right? You know, and nobody's in the moment. They're in their heads, in their thoughts, or in their imaginations. And so if Buddha holds up a flower, nobody is prepared to be present with this experience except Mahakashapa. Mahakashapa is dwelling in a kind of thoughtless state. And he's 100% present with what's happening, see. When we sit down on the cushion, you know, at first, may be difficult, you know. Sometimes I have things that go on during the day, and I come in here in this room on, say, a Wednesday night to sit, and it's hard for me to shake off what's happened during the day. Maybe something happened that was difficult or frightening or made me angry or something like that. And I sit down on the cushion and I'm watching the breath, but I can't put this down for a long time, you know. Or maybe you're sleepy. You know, some of you came here this morning, first thing in the morning. I love that, you know, and I'm so glad you came. And, you know, you're kind of tired and your mind drifts into sleep and out of sleep. You know, it's hard sometimes to become focused. You know, if you have been sitting here from 7 o'clock on, you know, by maybe 10:30, your legs really hurt. You know, they may really hurt, and you have to contend with your pain. So, you know, so Zen is not easy, if you keep working with it, you know, you eventually, if you follow the breath, eventually, your thoughts become fewer and fewer. And you will have intervals, at first very short intervals, but eventually longer intervals, where you feel centered or grounded in the breath or in emptiness, mu. And the thoughts are coming and going, but they don't really stick to you. You know, they don't really stick to you. Thoughts come and they go, and they come and they go like clouds in the sky, but your focus is the sky. So you're focused on your breath, or you're focused on mu, on emptiness, and the thoughts are coming and going, and there are these moments, these intervals, where there's actually no thought. There's just like no thought for a second or maybe a longer period. And when you're in that state, if you stay there, if you get there and you can stay there for just a little bit, it feels very different from ordinary waking consciousness, you know. And in Buddhism, this state is very, very highly valued. This state is called samadhi, samadhi. So when I say somebody is in deep samadhi, I mean they've gotten beyond the state. They're not identifying with their thoughts. They've separated themselves from their thoughts. The thoughts may be drifting by like clouds in the sky, and they keep coming back and fusing their attention with the breath or with mu. And this state of samadhi is really very, very transformative state. You know, if you ask yourself, what have I learned from my samadhi, you haven't learned anything. So, you know, you won't get necessarily an insight from being in deep samadhi. But you are transforming the way you process information, you know. If you're in deep samadhi and you walk outside and you're walking along the fountain's edge, when you hear that sound, it's so crisp, it's almost as though you merge with the sound. Or you feel the warmth of the sun on the stone under your feet. And that just seems to be you. That warmth becomes you. The barrier between ourself and the world drops away, and we experience everything around us with a kind of intimacy. Intimacy. You know, if there were one word that defined Buddhism, or defined Buddhism and defines Zen, you know, when people think of Zen, they think of like crazy monks, you know, meditating for 20 hours, or fierce monks living out in the forest, you know, on some mount, distant peak, and so on. You know, they have all these cliches. Sometimes Zen is thought to be a little, you know, like craziness or something. But if you ask me what Buddhism is all about, I would say it's about intimacy. You know, sometimes we aren't capable of intimacy with the people we love because we're too distracted, we're too fearful, or we're too frightened or angry, or we're too needy. Or, you know, you come home from work if you have a life partner. You come home from work and something's bothering you. Maybe your boss was giving you a hard time. You know, it's hard to be present with anybody else because you're still, your nerves are jangled, you're upset. And somebody might come into the kitchen and say, hey, how was your day? You might say, leave me alone. You know, I've got to be by myself for a while. You know, this is a state of being like besieged or fearful. Or maybe you're working on a difficult project in your job, and you come home and you're really frustrated, you know, angry. You couldn't get anywhere today. Somebody comes up to you and says, "How was your day?" And it's just like, you know, it's so hard to be open and present with that person because you're still locked in your inner drama, you know. And maybe you're the kind of person who has a lot of self-doubt. You know, so you go out to dinner with somebody and during the whole evening, you know, you're constantly wondering how that person is judging you or receiving you. And you become more and more tense about what's happening. Maybe this person doesn't like you, or maybe this person is... You know, we all do this kind of thing. But when we're in that state, it's very hard to be intimate, right? Intimate. You know, sometimes people get together and they sort of drop their boundaries, you know? You wake up one day, you call a friend, you say, want to go, you know, go have a cup of coffee. Sure. So he or she joins you for a cup of coffee, and there's no expectation, you know, and you're just together. And sometimes people can be so open and honest with one another because of that. That intimacy is there when people aren't trying too hard or when they're not caught up in their inner dramas, you know. Well, the kind of intimacy we have with people we love and trust is actually kind of small compared to the intimacy you can achieve through Zen, where you feel this deep sense of intimacy with everything around you. You know, everything becomes like your mother. Everything becomes like your father, if you had a good relationship with your father. You know, there's a kind of openness and intimacy. It's like meeting yourself outside, you know. You go outside and you hear that water. It's like meeting yourself, right? So this intimacy comes from not dwelling in our thoughts and in our projections, but beginning to separate from them and entering deep samadhi. And in deep samadhi, we're no longer a present as a self. It's just pure consciousness. Samadhi is really like pure consciousness without any content and without any thinker, actually. It may not feel that way when you're in it, but that's actually where you are. You know, because modern people put so much emphasis on thinking and ideas and innovation and the new, we don't really appreciate what samadhi is. People can enter samadhi, and many people don't even like it. They don't like the experience. You know? They become bored because they want to be back in the realm of thoughts. In Buddhism, there is a term. There are two terms that you should remember. One is called rupa, and the other is called arupa. Arupa. And arupa means form, or name and form. This is the world of conceptualization. And actually, this is where most people live their lives. But if you enter deep samadhi, you enter the realm of the arupa, the without form, without name and form. And now, when you experience things, you are experiencing them without any projections or presuppositions. And when this is at its most, when you are most open, it's like coming home. It's like coming home. It's like being held in your mother's arms, you know. I mean, this is what Buddhism is all about. It's being intimate with the world, being intimate with your life, see? So it's not about detachment. If somebody says Buddhism is about detachment, please don't listen to them. If somebody says Buddhism is about, you know, transcendence, put your fingers in your ears, you know, because that is not Buddhism. Buddhism is about intimacy with the world. So Mahakashapa holds up a flower. Shakyamuni, the Buddha, holds up a flower, and he's saying, "Can you be intimate with this flower, or are you too caught up in your stuff? Are you too caught up in your mental baggage to be present with this amazing flower?" See. Now, you know, everybody in the retinue, everybody in the Buddha's retinue is in his stuff or in her stuff, far from being intimate with the moment. So all these monks and nuns have come and they're not in deep samadhi. If they were in deep samadhi and the Buddha held up a flower, they'd be going, you know, they'd just think, wow, you know, I am the flower. I am that flower. So they don't get it, you know. The Buddha holds it up, and one of the arhats, one of the Buddha's foremost disciples, Mahakashapa, Kashapa, whose name, you know, Kashapa means drinker of light. That's Kashapa, drinker of the light. So a great drinker of light sees the flower, and he gets it. He's, wow, you know, intimacy. And the Buddha smiles back and says, way to go, man. Way to go. Brother, you know, brother. And they are, you know, basically, I am the flower and you are the flower. And I actually am you. And you actually are me. That is so far from the way human beings normally live, it's hard to believe, right? But that's actually what happens on Vulture Peak this day. So only Mahakashapa is able to experience intimacy because he's in deep samadhi, deep samadhi. He's in that thoughtless state when the Buddha holds up the flower and he becomes one with the flower. So, you know, the word Zen is often misunderstood. It's often translated as meditation or dhyana, dhyana. People say Zen comes from the Chinese. Zen is the Japanese pronunciation of chan, which is the Chinese pronunciation of dhyana, the Sanskrit dhyana, which means meditation. And if somebody says that, that too is not true. Dhyana means fusion or to become one with. So if somebody says that Zen is about meditation, you could say, well, yes, that's true, but the word Zen really means becoming one with. See, and this story is like Zen 101. Enter deep samadhi and become intimate with this moment. Be here. See, everybody else is incapable of being here now because they're in their stuff. They're overcome by thoughts, fears, self-doubt, neurotic chat, mental chattering. We all do it. That's why, you know, meditation is so essential. You know, it's possible, you know, let me just put it this way. You know, you could have slept in today. You know, you could have slept in, but you got up and you came here to sit. And it's possible to live without meditation. It's definitely true. There's about 7.8 billion people on Earth, and 7.7777777 don't meditate. So it's possible. But you know, you only live for a certain amount of time. You know, why not live? You know, why not live? You know, I have pain in my legs, too. You know, I got off an airplane last night, and I'm tired, you know. My legs hurt. I was hiking last week, and I was hiking with my old friend Larry Sullivan. Larry and I have been friends for more than 40 years. When we were teenagers, we went on hikes together in the Shenandoah Mountains outside of D.C. And now we're old codgers and we're hiking in the mountains. And Larry is like an amazing hiker. He's like a mountain man. He's a lawyer, but that's just how he makes his living, you know. He can run up a mountain. You know, it's just like nobody, and I was with a group of people, nobody could keep up with Larry Sullivan. And, you know, we hiked like 60 miles. And on the last day, I said, Larry, do your legs hurt? And he said, what do you mean? It's like, he wasn't laughing. I was laughing because his legs didn't hurt, you know. I could barely walk, you know. So, you know, I've been hiking with Larry Sullivan, who walked my legs off, basically. My legs hurt today, you know, but it's a small price to pay for the intimacy you feel when all your barriers go away. Life is short. As you get older, it gets shorter and shorter. You think, what kind of life do I want to live? And that feeling of connectedness or one being one with is so precious, right? I think. It's so precious, you know. So it's not so hard to get up in the morning. If once you begin to experience that intimacy, I don't think you'll stop. You know, once you really have a deep experience of that intimacy, you realize, gee, this is the best way to live. I really believe this. You know, I mean, why live without this? You know, why live without intimacy? You know, that's, people do it. You know, people live without intimacy in their relationships. That's a very most common human way to be, is without intimacy. But once you taste that intimacy, it's just so wonderful. You know, I was up in the mountains in eastern Oregon. And we were staying in, they're called the Wallowa Mountains. It looks like Wallowa, but it's pronounced Wallowa. And we were staying on this beautiful, beautiful pond. And you know, when people are out in nature like that, they experience intimacy because just being in nature puts your mind at rest. You stop thinking. And people fall into a kind of natural samadhi, you know. This beautiful alpine mountain pond, surrounded by spruce trees and pine trees. And it's like 6,000 feet up, so there's no mosquitoes, you know. And all these strangers have hiked up to this place, and you know, people were bathing. Some people had bathing trunks on. Some people didn't have their trunks on, you know. And people were jumping in with normal human bodies, you know. People were having so much fun. You know, two people took off their clothes and jumped in at one end of the pond. Somebody was sitting on another part of the pond and said, "Hey, what do you think this is, a nudist colony?" And somebody who jumped in the water said, "Yeah, I thought that's what this was," you know, and everybody was laughing. People were so open, you know, and kind to each other, right? And non-judgmental. And, you know, they'd all worked hard. You have to hike up there, and it's a killer of a hike, you know, so that's like doing Zazen. You know, your legs hurt. Your barriers are down. After a 7-mile hike straight up, you don't really care how you look, you know. And then, you know, you're in this natural setting that is disarming. Everybody's pretty much there to be present with what's around them. And this kind of natural intimacy, you know. And you think, this is heaven. When people can be like this with each other, like gentle and kind, and they're like, you know, there were two people older than I am, maybe in their 70s, you know. And they were like kids, you know, in the water. And this is intimacy with the world, right? You know. So Zazen, you know, intimacy can happen if you hike up a mountain and you go to a mountain lake, but it might not. If you have enough baggage, even there, you know, your mind will be a cauldron of unhappiness. You know, and you can distract yourself. People are very good at distracting themselves, but that's not intimacy. That's just like a drug, you know. So Zen is about cultivating intimacy, you know, being intimate with the world all the time. And Mahakashapa was able to appreciate this and be intimate with the flower when Shakyamuni, the Buddha, held it up. And they smiled at each other. And this is really what Zen is all about. You know, in Zen we talk about this idea of transmission. Transmission. So, the Buddha was after the Buddha there was Mahakashapa. There was, you know, after Mahakashapa somebody else. And we speak of a transmission from the Buddha down to contemporaries and teachers. So everybody who is a Zen practitioner or Buddhist today is really like a part of a transmission from the Buddha. And some people think there's what gets transmitted. Is it the sutras? Is it, you know, some special charisma? You know, it's none of those things. You know, there's really nothing to transmit. You just have to be present for what's happening in the moment. When Shakyamuni Buddha was at Vulture Peak, he held out a flower to his listeners. Everyone was silent. Only Mahakashapa broke into a broad smile. The Buddha said, "I have the true Dharma eye, the marvelous mind of Nirvana, the true form of the formless, Arupa, and the subtle Dharma gate, independent of words and transmitted beyond all doctrine. I have entrusted this to Mahakashapa." So people probably left thinking, well, what insight was it? And they're thinking. But of course, that's not the path. Mumon's comment, golden-faced Gautama, the Buddha. Now remember, Zen is about not being self-centered, you know. So when you want to pay somebody a compliment in classical Zen, you appear to be insulting them. So here, Mumon seems to be insulting the Buddha, but he's really paying him a great compliment. So you have to be careful about Zen language sometimes. Golden-faced Gautama really disregarded his listeners. He made the good look bad, and he sold dog meat labeled as mutton. In other words, he imparted a great truth on this occasion. He himself thought it was wonderful. If, however, everyone in the audience had laughed, how could he have transmitted his true eye? And again, if Mahakashapa had not smiled, how could the Buddha have transmitted it? See, I mean, Mulan's playing a game with us because there's nothing to transmit. Just be here now. If you say the true eye of Dharma can be transmitted, then the golden-faced old man would be a city slicker who cheats the country bumpkins. If you say it cannot be transmitted, then why did the Buddha approve of Mahakashapa? Mumon's verse, holding out a flower, the Buddha revealed his curly tail. He has a curly tail like a non-human form, life form. Heaven and earth were bewildered at Mahakashapa's smile. So thank you for coming here today and to be intimate with this beautiful moment, this beautiful life.